Sunshine on a rainy day makes my soul trip, trip, trip away. Have you ever felt like that? The moment on a rainy day when the sunshine suddenly breaks through the clouds, and just for a moment, just a moment, you feel like your soul's taken flight. Almost an out-of-body experience, when everything feels beautiful and good. Like you've tapped into something deeper, something real, something profoundly meaningful and significant. The moment when the morning sunlight shining through a window catches the dust in the air. And it's all you can do not to just sit down on the floor and weep because of how beautiful it is. The Sunday afternoon at Little Creatures, sitting out on the back deck, pale ale in hand, salt water in the air, all your friends talking and laughing. The moment when you just sit back and soak it all up and think, this is good. This is what life is all about. That moment of sheer joy and delight, when for a split second you get a taste of transcendence, a taste of something beyond the ordinary, almost beyond this world. That fleeting moment of sheer pleasure when you think, yeah, this is what life's all about. This is what I was made for. Because pleasure promises us something, doesn't it? It's not just having your nerve endings stimulated. It's not just physical gratification, as nice as that might be. Pleasure, at its best, gives us a sense that life is meaningful. We may not feel it every day, but in those rare moments, we experience some kind of transcendence, some kind of escape from the ordinary, a fleeting sense of purpose and significance. A glimpse of real meaning breaking through, like sunshine on a rainy day. This week, the Christian Union is doing a series of talks on the book of Ecclesiastes, which is one of the books from the Bible, from the Old Testament. And it's a fascinating book. It's not long, just over 5,000 words in the English. And it's probably the closest thing we get to raw philosophy in the Bible. It's deeply thought-provoking, deeply profound. And at heart, it's a book about meaning, what life is all about. And it's written by someone who calls himself the teacher, but he's more like a philosophy professor, really. And he's on a quest to find the meaning of life. And the big question that he spends the whole book sort of grappling with is, what can someone gain from life? Now, what does man gain from all his labour at which he toils under the sun? What's the point of it all? What profit can you get from life? And his conclusion is nothing. Meaningless, meaningless, utterly meaningless. Everything is meaningless. In chapter 1, which we looked at yesterday, he looks at the world and he notes that nothing ever changes. Generations come and generations go, but the earth remains forever. Is there anything of which one can say, look, this is something new? He says, no. No, there's not. He's not unaware that people invent things. He knows that. We do make new discoveries, but nothing ever really changes about life. See, regardless of whether you're writing on a clay tablet or an iPad, life is still pretty much the same. You're born, you live, you work, you eat some stuff, you drink some stuff. You get old and you die. Nothing ever changes, year after year, generation after generation. And so in chapter 2, he embarks on this series of experiments to see if there's some way that he can squeeze some meaning out of life. He looks at a few different things, pleasure, wisdom, work. We're going to look at work tomorrow and wisdom on Thursday, but today we're looking at pleasure. Is there something that can actually be gained from pleasure? So let's have a look at his experiment. You've got the passage in front of you. In chapter 2, verse 1, let's have a look at that. This is the start of his experiment. I thought in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure to find out what is good. And pleasure's not a bad place to start the experiment, is it? Like I said, it does give us those sort of moments when we feel like we've tapped into something bigger, something meaningful. There's a little bit of hope there. So in chapter 2, verse 3, he decides to engage in pleasure. He does what lots of people do when they feel like their life is meaningless. He hits the terps. I tried cheering myself with wine and embracing folly. Life's pointless. Let's go get smashed. But he says that the whole time my mind was still guiding me with wisdom. I wanted to see what was worthwhile for people to do under heaven during the few days of their lives. Even in the midst of his drunken stupidity, he's still kind of outside himself, looking down on himself, always asking, is this working? Is this doing anything? Am I getting anything from this? Is this producing any real meaning? In verses 4 to 8, he gets a bit more extravagant and he starts dumping all his resources into pleasure. And this is a guy with a lot of resources. He's the king over an entire country. He builds his dream home, his dream homes, actually. Plants a vineyard, builds a winery, buys slaves to run it all. He accumulates herds and flocks, silver and gold, huge sums of money, the treasure of kings and provinces. He owns more herds and flocks than anyone in Jerusalem before him. He acquires men and women singers and a harem as well, his own personal brothel. The harem might come as a bit of a shock. That doesn't sort of seem like the kind of thing an author of the Bible should really be doing, you know, having a harem. But he doesn't care about that. He's not interested in whether it's moral or not. He just wants to know whether it works. Does it produce any meaning? Why do people have sex? A lot of people do, have been doing for a long time. Might come as a disturbing shock to you, but even your parents had sex. Who knows, they might still be having sex. Why do they do it? Why do people engage in sex? In the song we heard before, Christine Arnoux sings, "You touch me with your spirit, you touch me with your heart, you touch me in the dark." And the touching in the dark is nice, it's exciting. But it's the touching in the spirit and the heart that really matters. If sex was just physical stimulation, people would just stay at home and masturbate. But they don't. They want to have sex with other people. It's about the touching of spirits and hearts. And you see that when sex is abused, when children are molested or people are raped. The physical damage doesn't take that long to get over, but it's the emotional and psychological and spiritual damage that lasts for years and years, sometimes someone's whole life. But that's why when sex goes right, it is so good. And sex going right has very little to do with physical technique. It's got much more to do with what's happening emotionally and psychologically and spiritually. I kind of wonder if that's why we live in such a sex-saturated culture. That it's not because we're just like other animals. It's precisely because we're not. We crave meaning. Maybe sex is everywhere, not because we're sexually liberated, but because we're trapped. We're trapped by the meaninglessness of our lives and we're desperately looking for some way out. Some way of knowing that we're significant, that we matter. And that's why sex is so powerful. Because in sex we feel like we really do matter. We matter so much to someone that they gave themselves to us. I think that's what lots of people are looking for in sex. They're trying to capture that moment of transcendence. That moment of feeling like, this is what life is all about. I matter. It's a feeling that is so wonderful, but it's so fleeting. The teacher tries every kind of pleasure in the hope that somehow he'll discover something worthwhile, anything, anything that he can profit from, anything that will transcend the meaninglessness of life. And like I said, he's got some serious resources to throw at the problem. And it's worth learning from him. Now, when you're not massively rich, the temptation is to think that if only I had some more money, if only I had more resources to throw at this problem, then I could actually overcome this meaninglessness barrier. If only I could buy an iPad or travel to Europe. If only I could own my own home. If only I had as much money as Bill Gates. Then I'd matter. My life would have meaning. But it's not true. I mean, look at the rich. Look at the 1%. Are they happy? Well, some of them are. But most of them aren't. Jim Carrey says, "I think everybody should get rich and famous and do everything they ever dreamed of so they can see that it's not the answer." The teacher discovers the same thing. "I denied myself nothing my eyes desired. I refused my heart no pleasure. My heart took delight in all my work, and this was the reward for all my labour. Yet when I surveyed all that my hands had done and what I had toiled to achieve, everything was meaningless. A chasing after the wind. Nothing was gained under the sun." And what's the problem? He's got enormous resources, huge wealth, the ability to spend them on all sorts of things, all these things that ought to give him pleasure, and they're not. Why not? What's gone wrong? Well, the problem with all these things, all these experiences, accumulating all this stuff, is that it's really just like playing Monopoly. You know, you can have a lovely time playing Monopoly, buying properties, doing deals, taking out mortgages, building houses and hotels, trying to make more money than anyone else, try to acquire Mayfair and Park Lane. Great fun. But when the game finishes, you don't get to take any of your winnings with you. Your Monopoly money doesn't count in the real world. At the end of the day, it all goes back in the box. And that is life. Doesn't matter how much money you make or how much fun you have, none of it counts when it comes to death. At the end of the day, it all goes back in the box. And the teacher looks at a world where everyone thinks that he who dies with the most toys wins. And he says, "You fools. You fools. Can't you see that he who dies with the most toys still dies? You don't get to take your toys with you." What does man gain from all his labour at which he toils under the sun? Pleasure looks like it has potential, not just because it feels good in the raw physical sense, but because it gives us these moments of transcendence, moments when we feel like we've tapped into what life's all about. But there's a problem, and it's not just that the feeling never lasts. It's that whatever it was that might have given you pleasure, money, drugs, sex, sunshine on a rainy day, it all gets taken away by death. Now, you've got to realise that this is not just a problem for atheists. This is a problem for everyone. The fact that there really is a God who really will raise the dead, and the fact that you might believe that Jesus is your saviour who died for your sins, it doesn't mean that you get to take your flat-screen TV with you when you go. No, it gets taken off you. My wife and I went to the UK a couple of years ago just for a holiday. And when I got to the security area where they screen your bag, they put my bag through the scanner, and there was kind of some muttering from behind the thing, and bag came out and they put it back around and put it through again and paused and had a bit of a look at it. And then they called me over and they got me to open up the bag. And there, sitting at the top, was my shampoo. Just a 400ml container of shampoo. But of course, you can't take more than 100 mils on the flight with you. And they must have thought that I was a formidable looking character, that I might have taken over the plane with my shampoo bottle. So they confiscated my shampoo from me. They just took it away. I never saw it again. Is that overkill? Yeah, I reckon it is. But those guys have got nothing on death. When you get to the security checkpoint of death, everything gets taken away. Naked a man comes from his mother's womb, and as he comes, so he departs. This is not a secret. This is not a new discovery. We know this. We know that we can take nothing with us. And yet so often all we do is we redouble our efforts. We just try harder to enjoy ourselves. And when that happens, pleasure just stops being pleasurable. In fact, it becomes sad and desperate and often evil. We end up with the destruction of pleasure. In chapter 5, verse 8, the teacher writes, "If you see the poor oppressed in a district and justice and rights denied, don't be surprised at such things. For one official is eyed by a higher one, and over them both are others higher still. The increase from the land is taken by all. The king himself profits from the fields. Whoever loves money never has money enough. Whoever loves wealth is never satisfied with his income. This too is meaningless." In the face of death, pleasure becomes meaningless. But that doesn't stop people from trampling over others in the attempt to get more of it. Why do they do it? Is it because they need more money to survive? No, not at all. But because they hope that with more money, they might be able to get just a bit more pleasure, and with just that bit more pleasure, they might actually crack through, break through, and actually get some real meaning out of life. Hoping that somehow this will count for something. But it never does. It can't. Because death is always there, watching our frantic attempts to enjoy ourselves and laughing. It gets worse. Because as we become more and more desperate in our efforts at pleasure, we not only fail to produce meaning, we stop enjoying the things we could have taken pleasure in. When your whole life depends on the beer at Little Creatures, it's hard to enjoy the beer. When everything hangs on a particular relationship, well, it's hard to enjoy that because you're just so anxious that you'll lose it. It's like that line in one of U2's songs, "You can hold on to something so tight you've already lost it." You become so anxious about losing it, you never really enjoy it. And when you discover that that relationship is not working anymore, it's not giving you those moments of transcendence, well, you just stop finding pleasure in it, and so you move on to the next one and ruin that one too. I wonder if this is why celebrities seem to churn through marriages so quickly. So they've accumulated enough money to realise that money can't buy you happiness. They've tried it and it doesn't work. So they turn to something that they can't buy, marriage, in the hope that that will give their lives meaning. But that is a terrible burden to put on someone. To say to someone, "It's up to you to make my life meaningful." They can't possibly do it. So when the initial romance and excitement wears off and they realise that their marriage isn't giving their lives real meaning, they just ditch it and move on to the next one. Rinse and repeat. Pleasure gives us hints of real meaning in life, but it never fully delivers. It can't, because death is always waiting there, always waiting to take off anything from us, take anything from us that we've enjoyed. And when we rely on pleasure for meaning, we not only fail to produce meaning, we ruin the pleasure. So what's the solution? Should we just give up on pleasure and become ascetics? You know, retreat into the desert, whipping ourselves as we go? Should we go down the Buddhist route and recognise that all suffering comes from desire, and so attempt to empty ourselves of desire? Well, no. The solution isn't to reject pleasure, but to take pleasure in something that death can't take away from you. Something that doesn't just go back in the box when the game of life is finally over. What is it? What can you take hold of that will survive death? Here's what the teacher says in chapter 3. I've seen the burden God has laid on men. He's made everything beautiful in its time. He's also set eternity in the hearts of men. Yet they cannot fathom what God has done from beginning to end. I know that there's nothing better for men than to be happy and do good while they live, that everyone may eat and drink and find satisfaction in all his toil. This is the gift of God. I know that everything God does will endure forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it. God does it so that men will revere him. What's he saying? He's saying that God has deliberately set up life this way. He's put eternity in our hearts. Those moments at Little Creatures with the beer and the sunshine and the friends, they're not an accident. They're a gift of God. They're his deliberate intention. Yet nothing we do endures. We can't add or subtract anything from what God does. There's nothing that we gain from life, nothing that we can take with us beyond death. Well, why would God do that? Why would he set up life that way, where we have these glimpses and longings for eternity, and then everything that we might gain is just taken away from us by death? Why would he do that? Is he cruel? Is he sadistic? No. He's gracious. He does it so that we'll realise that there is only one thing that can give life real meaning. Only one genuinely lasting pleasure. Himself. Everything else will be taken away by death. But God won't. The teacher says God does it so that people will revere him. He's set up life so that he is the only thing worth delighting in. Everything else gets taken away by death. And if you rely on them for meaning, your life will be meaningless and you'll always be anxious, desperately clutching for those moments of transcendence, always trying to manufacture them again, but it never really works, does it? Always coming up empty-handed. But if you delight in God, you can relax, because you've finally found the one thing that will last beyond death, the one thing you actually can take with you. You've discovered the one person who really can make your life meaningful. So how do you delight in God? Well, it turns out that it's actually quite easy. You get to know him. You read his revelation of himself in the Bible, and especially his revelation of himself in Jesus. And Jesus says, anyone who has seen me has seen the Father. And when you see Jesus, when you read about him in the Bible, you discover that he is delightful. He's wonderful. Compassionate and gracious, upright and true, full of faithfulness and love, patient and kind, hating what's evil and loving what's good. Jesus is not some pleasure-hating wretch who's out to make everyone's life miserable. In fact, he's usually getting into trouble for turning up at parties with the wrong crowd and just having too much of a good time. At one party, he even turns 100 litres of water into wine. This is not a guy who is down on the idea of pleasure. But he's on about real pleasure. Actually knowing God and having a relationship with him. See, our fundamental problem as humans is that we've stopped taking pleasure in God. We've stopped delighting in him. We've rejected him and chased after everything else instead, but nothing else delivers. And in the end, as we persist in our rejection of God, he will give us what we want. Total separation from him. But to be cut off from God is to be cut off from the source of everything that is good. To be cut off from God is hell. And that's where we're heading. That's what we deserve. In a weird, warped, sick kind of twisted way, that's what we want. But Jesus came to rescue us from that misery. In his death on the cross, he was cut off from everything that makes life good. Everything you can imagine, even the ultimate good of relationship with God. He experienced hell in our place, cut off from everything good instead of us, so that we could experience the ultimate pleasure of relationship with God. Now, if you don't have that relationship, then it is hard to understand just how good it is. I get that. I get that it's difficult to understand that. But you ought to try it. If for no other reason, then nothing else lasts. Jesus' death wasn't the end for him. God raised him from the dead to enjoy the unending pleasure of eternal relationship with him. And Jesus' resurrection shows us the future for us too, if we turn back to God and trust in Jesus' death for us. Eternal relationship with God. It's a fantastic thing if you know anything about what God is like. He's wonderful. And one of the interesting things, one of the brilliant effects of accepting Jesus' death in your place, of delighting in relationship with God, is that you're actually set free to enjoy life now. The beer on a Friday afternoon, listening to your favourite song, hanging out with your mates, you're actually set free to enjoy them just for what they are. The good gifts of God, instead of ruining them by putting the whole weight of the meaning of your life on them. It's a weight that they can't possibly sustain. You just end up ruining the thing you could have taken pleasure in. If you make pleasure your God, you won't even get real pleasure. But if you take pleasure in God, you get to take pleasure in life now as well. Jesus is what that transcendence points towards, that relationship with God. He's everything that sunshine on a rainy day points towards. And when you know him, when you delight in him, you can enjoy the sunshine for what it is, instead of trying to make it what life's all about. Thank you. All right, no need to clap, that's all right, but thank you. Any questions that you've got about that?
But it seems so obvious that, like, you know, marriage, sex, celebrity, richness, fame, yada yada yada, get the job done. Like Jim Carrey even points it out, blah blah blah.
Yep.
Why is it so radical society and even us with us just to see that as simple reality? Like why do people sort of seem to catch on to that and sort of laugh when the celebrity gets married because they're like, ooh, wow, you know?
Yeah. Sam's asking if it's so obvious that nothing else can sort of deliver real meaning and pleasure in life, then why do people persist in doing it? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah,
I think it's because, well, there's probably lots of things going on, but I think part of it is that if you don't have any answer, what else is there to do? You've just got to kind of keep going in the hope that something will happen. Maybe there's just something around the corner that will work, but it never does. And I think the other thing is that at the heart of all of us, we really want to be God. We want to be in charge of everything and decide what we're going to do. And to admit that actually our whole life and enjoyment and happiness depends on acknowledging God for who he is and recognising that we're not God, well, that runs against everything that I want to do. I can't be God if I've got to admit that there's another God, a real God. So I think that's part of it as well. Yeah. Any other questions? Yeah. Could I phrase it a different way? What do I mean by transcendence? I mean that moment where you feel like, almost like you've escaped everyday life and tapped into what life is all about. You know, most of the time we're just kind of going through the motions, doing our stuff. But occasionally you get these moments where you feel like, oh, that's what I'm here for. That's what life's all about. So that's what I mean by transcendence. And I think those little inklings, those little moments of delight are actually pointing us towards the fact that there is the possibility of real transcendence. But when we try and grab those things, when we think, oh, I had such a great moment down at Little Creatures on Saturday, this sermon brought to you by Little Creatures, when you try and do it again the next weekend, it doesn't quite work the same. And you try and grab hold of it and it's just gone. But we keep rushing around trying one thing and the next. But that inkling that there is real transcendence, I think, is true. It's just that you can't get it through all the things that we try and get it through normally, because they all get taken away by death. The only thing that doesn't get taken away is God. Yeah. Does that help? Yeah.
Sorry, can I quickly...
Yeah.
So it means it makes you see something that's bigger than just ordinary life. Routine, rat race, that sort of thing.
Maybe a way of putting it is that it makes you feel, it's that moment where you feel like you've escaped yourself as the subject and tapped into real objective reality, that, you know, this is what it's all about. Someone had a hand up. Yep.
What about pleasure, but what about pain, which is like
Yeah, so Jesse's asked, what about suffering and pain, and particularly something like the suffering of people in third world countries? Is that meaningful? And I think the answer is that if death is the end, if that's it, then no. Because we're all going to die sooner or later, and how we died really doesn't matter. But if death is not the end, then people are incredibly important. You know, whether we manage to extend their life any longer, I mean... What's the right way to put this? I think what you find is that when you know God, when you delight in him and find out how much he loves us, you can't help but want to love other people. It's just, I don't know, just kind of like you're a cup that gets filled up and you sort of overflow. When you get filled up with God's love and you understand how much he's loved us in Jesus, you can't help but overflow in love towards others. And so in that sense, I think that's a meaningful thing to do. But it only works if God is your ultimate source of meaning in life, because otherwise you're just extending the life of someone who's going to die anyway, and who cares, really? I mean, I think we all instinctively feel like that does matter. You know, we should care. I think that's absolutely right. But I think it only works if you know God. Yeah. Otherwise, it just becomes another sort of narcissistic kind of thing where you end up with the sort of, what do they call it? Conspicuous compassion, where I use these suffering people in whatever country to make myself feel good. But that's just sort of sophisticated selfishness, really. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you think Solomon, in a way, could be like a background for
Yeah, so David's asking is, do you think Solomon, who is probably the teacher here, is he sort of just preparing the ground for us to understand Jesus? Yeah, I think in some ways he is, yeah. He's showing that it doesn't matter. Everything else you look to in life, it all gets taken away by death. So it's all just a waste of time, really. But if you know Jesus, you know God, and that actually makes life meaningful and wonderful. And it means that everything in life is something that you can take delight in. All the good things you experience are good gifts from God. They're not just things that are about to disappear at any moment. We should finish, and I'll hand back to Dan. So thank you. And yeah, I'll get it then.